Hello, and welcome to So You Think You Can Rule Persia, the podcast where we rate and review all the kings of Persia from Dayokis to Yazdegerd III. I am Sariel, and my pronouns are they, them.
And I'm Umberto, and my pronouns are he, him. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 61, Hormizd I, where we've had a good time with Ardashir and Shapur. Will the third Sassanid king be very good as well? Will he be less good? Will he be even better? Who knows? We're here to find out. What are your expectations, Ariel? Do you think that it's going to be the heir hand chosen by Shapur among all the ranked sons that he had? Do you think he's going to do a good job or no?
We should trust him, right? In the sense of like because of how on top of everything he was and how micromanaging he was and apparently like... you know, very good in most of his decisions. Mm-hmm. But also, I still remember that you mentioned we never have three Shahanshahs in a row.
We haven't had any, and so... it would be difficult, but who knows? Maybe this is the case.
Yeah. But, so, I'm, you know, I am deliberating how bad is it going to be.
It's going to be complete disaster or basically fine, just not outstanding.
Exactly. Like, will I be sad, or is it just going to be fine, just not as impressive?
Yeah, well, we'll find out. We'll see how it all turns out. Also, just because people might notice, I'm going to go with the pronunciation Hormizd, and that's also the spelling that's in the episode. Know that it can also be spelled Hormazd, Hormazd, or Hormizdus. And yeah, it's just basically different versions of how the name is converted into English. I went with Hormizd because that's what was in the first source I read and I just had to pick one. So yeah, screw it. Let's go with this.
That's the one you became familiar with. So
yeah, exactly. And this makes researching Hormizd's very complicated because you don't know what the author of the book you're looking in has gone with. You just need to try all of them. Because some start with an H, others start with an O, and it's just, I don't know, I'll try both. Let's see how it goes. So, now you know. But okay, before we get started, let's just have a brief recap of what Shapur did. So, Shapur was the second Sassanid king. He took the throne after co-ruling with his father for a while. Then he had a series of successful things. He had three successful wars against the Romans, shown in his lovely relief, where he killed Gordian III, humiliated Philip the Arab, defeated an army without an emperor, and then imprisoned Valerian and made him a taxidermy coat hanger.
Well, that was according to you.
Yeah, could be. Who knows? Might be. And then he also ensured that the east of the empire was basically expanding against the Kushans with the help of this new Kushano-Sassanid dynasty that was established. Inside the empire, he deported a bunch of people from the east of the Roman Empire into Mesopotamia to people it and repopulate the area. So that went well. The economy is flourishing. The empire is doing very well. We have religious tolerance. And we saw that this new religion of Manichaeanism is spreading. And there'll be more on that today. But yeah, at the end of Shapur's life, he ranked all his sons in order of merit and decided, this is the line of succession, please follow it. Okay, bye. And this is the world we're left in. No Shapur. It's been about 50 years since the Sassanid dynasty has started, so we're well and truly into this new age.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so Hormizd was born as the son of Shapur I, and his original name was Hormizd Ardashir, and he may have been the third oldest son, based on some inscriptions that Shapur has.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the name Hormizd is referring to the chief god of Zoroastrianism, Ahura Mazda, also known as Hormazd or Hormizd. So there we are. According to a popular tradition, it looks like Hormizd was the son of a minor Parthian princess that was left over from the old kingdom, but we have no proof of it. It's just something people believe. And also, for his year of birth, we don't really have a clean date, but we can have an estimate between 210 and 230, combining his father's age and his own accomplishments. That's roughly when he was born. So that would make him between 40 and 60 when he gets the throne. So he is an older man.
Interesting.
And he's also, interestingly enough, part of the generation that no longer remembers the Parthian Empire.
Ah.
His generation has always been in the Sassanid Empire. They do not remember what came before.
Wow. That's
so that's interesting.
Terrifying.
We've moved on. Yes. Yeah. Generations pass, and they always have. So there we are.
Humanity forgets.
As for his youth, we don't know too much about him as a very young prince, but he immediately jumps to center stage during Shapur's Roman Wars, because he became known for his skill in battle, and certain texts even call him Hormizd the Brave, so that's pretty good. These texts also tell us that he looked a lot like his grandfather Ardashir, but people who had known both said that he wasn't as wise. The first king was a wiser king. He was better overall. But yeah, there we are. So he's making a name for himself. He's a good young prince. He's helping his father against the Romans, and things are going well. They're going so well that, as I mentioned before, we have Inderes Geste Divi Saporis, so the deeds of Shapur that he himself wrote. Hormizd is the first in the list of those who received a fire of good renown, so a religious dedication. So his is first in the list, so first by merit. But he is third in the generic list of members of the royal family for whom sacrifices were made.
Mm-hmm.
So scholars have interpreted this as saying that Hormizd was the third oldest son, but he was recognized as the first in merit by his father. So since he was chosen as heir, that makes sense. That matches up. And another indicator of Shapur's favor is that in 252, once Shapur had conquered Armenia, he made Hormizd king of Armenia. So Hormizd is now the largest, most powerful vassal king in all of the empire, and in a border region with the Romans, so this is a big responsibility, and clearly he is trusted enough to do this. He is trusted to be capable and effective at his job. So that's nice. And in his new position, Hormizd did not disappoint. He helped out his father in the wars against the Romans. He conducted some independent campaigns raiding Cappadocia. He sent aid to the war in Syria. And it looks like it was Hormizd himself who captured the port of Antioch before the main assault that conquered the city.
Okay.
So he's helping out, doing a great story. And then we get a very, very likely mythical story from Altabari about Hormizd. It goes a little bit like this. Apparently, there were people in the court that were jealous of Hormizd and wanted to get rid of him, as they often do. Scheming courtiers be scheming. So the courtiers told Shapur that Hormizd was planning to usurp the throne, and if he wanted proof of this, he should ask Hormizd to come to him, and if he won't come, that's proof of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Which reminds me a lot of Cambyses and Bardia.
Yeah.
A million years ago, but it was a very similar story, so who knows, it might be echoes of that. But the problem is that Hormizd can't come. But he doesn't want his father to be suspicious. Hormizd is busy ruling Armenia. He had a job to do. He doesn't want to abandon his duty.
So was this done on purpose so that he wouldn't show up?
Very probably, yes. The courtiers probably knew that, you know, if he does show up, you can say, ah, look, but you were meant to be king of Armenia. You're abandoning your duty. And if he doesn't show up, it's like, ah, he's clearly planning a rebellion. There we go.
We've seen this before, yeah.
Yeah, it always happens. But Hormizd is a very loyal son, and he wants to make sure that his father knows that he is loyal, and he is doing his job, and he's not going to betray him. So what do you think Hormizd does? What could he do to prove his loyalty to his father? He is meant to go to the capital to report to him, but he can't because that would be abandoning his post. What would you do, Serial?
I don't know why my first idea was just make the city where you are the capital. But I don't think that's an option.
He doesn't have that authority, but, you know, option.
Yeah.
Good option.
I don't know. What did he do?
Well, he decides to cut off his hand and send it to Shapur saying,
oh, God.
Listen, to be a king, you need to be whole of body. I care more about being loyal to you than eventually being king, so here's my hand as proof that I'm not trying to usurp. I am just loyal to you.
That is terrifying. As much as possible.
Yes, it's intense.
Very intense. Oof.
Yes, it's a lot. And, well, Shapur was sufficiently convinced that his son was not going to betray him, and he was shocked, of course, at receiving his son's hand, and he said that, no, Hormizd, you're going to be my heir no matter what. Even if you cut off your body piece by piece, you're the only one I want to be my heir. I trust you implicitly. Oof. I don't care what the law is. Because
I was going to say,
didn't
we just, like, ruin the entire plan?
Yeah, but he said, no, I don't care. You've clearly proven that you're loyal and capable. Okay. I don't care what this is. You're my heir. You're succeeding. So let's go. And yeah, so at this point, the time came for Shapur. And in 270, he died and Hormizd was made King of Kings. So he's upgraded from King of Armenia to King of all Iran. Now, unfortunately, we don't have too many sources on his reign, but we have interesting information nonetheless. Because first of all, it looks like he followed in the steps of his father and grandfather with founding new cities. And he also continued to use the title of King of Kings of Iran and non-Iran. So that's nice. The sources also tell us that he was a just and benevolent ruler, although a bit inferior to his predecessors, because they were such remarkable men. And he is said to have valued prudence, the ability to ward off unnecessary risks, bravery, rigorous adherence to his word, and generosity. So, all very nice things. That's good. He seems like a nice, capable man who is doing a good job. But the main bit of information we get is of religious nature, because as we saw, religion is becoming more and more important in these times. And the main conflict here is between Zoroastrianism, represented by the head priest Kartir, who I told you to remember last time, and Manichaeanism, who is being led by their prophet Mani. So how does this conflict manifest? Because on the one hand, Kartir was invested by Hormizd with great honors. He was made high priest, and he was given the authority to organize the Zoroastrian religion. Because it was sort of a process a bit like the Council of Nicaea, where he collected a bunch of different Mazdean traditions from the empire, and everybody was trying to decide which is the orthodox version, which is the correct version of the religion, and which are, you know, regional breakoffs. Like, what do we all agree on? And what is just a weird thing that you do in your region?
What is the right way to do religion and the wrong way to do religion?
Yeah, pretty much. Because
this has never been an issue, you know?
Yeah, it will become an issue for so
many
things.
Never caused
a
problem,
good
ever.
Lord. Yes, so difficult. And yeah, well, apparently Kartir is being given authority to decide which is the correct version of the religion. He's interrogating all the priests from across the empire and, you know, making a list saying, okay, everybody agrees that this is what God is like. There is disagreement on this. Mm-hmm. Here's what we're going with. So there we are. It's also kind of sketchy that it's possible that Ardashir himself was a heretic.
Oh.
The founder of the dynasty may have been slightly heretical and it was like swept under the rug, but we don't know enough because, well, he's the mythical founder. We can't have him look bad.
It's also like, you know, I don't know if when Ardashir, when he founded this new dynasty, like, did he make a big, I was going to say a big fuss, but no, like, did he make religion a big part of his, like, new plan for this region?
Well, he did make it a pretty big part of the region because, well, the Sassanid family traditionally had, like, a fire temple. They were the guardians of this temple.
Okay.
And when Ardashir came to the throne, again, since he's not a mythical figure, like, he is clearly historical, but since he's the founder, there's a lot of things that are attributed to him by later rulers saying, ah, look, if the first king said so, then of course we have to do this. But there is a saying attributed to him that, you know, the religion and the state are intertwined irreversibly and one must sustain the other. So there is definitely some importance there.
Right, okay. But so what was the kind of like, what were the rules of this particular religion that he installed? Because it would be really strange for him to be like, this is the religion we're going with, but I personally believe this other
version
of it. Like, same religion, but, you know, like, it strikes me as something so strange that the same person who chooses what the royal religion is going to be is not, like, supporting that same version of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's mostly that, from my understanding of it, it's that Ardashir didn't really, like, he thought that general Mazdaism was the religion to follow, but he didn't really look into the minutiae of what is exactly the deal with the Yazatas. How do they refer to Ahura Mazda? How does he refer to Ahriman? How does this refer to the material world? He probably said, I worship this deity, this collection of deities. I think this is the way to go. You can work out the details. It's sort of like how, you know, despite Constantine the Great convening the Council of Nicaea, some of his heirs were Arian Christians and disagreed with the Council of Nicaea. So it was like, you know, they didn't really care much about the details and left it to someone else to figure out, Cartier in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cartier, when he came out with his version, turns out the original was kind of heretical, but we're not going to make a big fuss about it.
Okay. Okay, so I see how it happened. Because it would be really strange if you are the one in charge of deciding what is and what isn't heretical, or like which one to push for, and then yourself would be, you know, not quite.
Yeah. It's been about 50 years since Ardashir first came onto the scene. It's been 30 years since he was king. So presumably,
true,
as time has evolved and different people have started discussing, probably a new type of consensus has started.
Yeah, that would make sense. Then I don't find it that surprising. I guess it makes sense to swipe it under the rug because you want everything to be consistent and to have like as many backing, you know, reasons as possible for like the legitimacy of the entire dynasty. But yeah.
Yeah. And also, I say that we're determining what orthodoxy is. It's going to take the rest of the lifetime of the empire to fully establish what orthodoxy is. Like, orthodoxy becomes what it actually is roughly today when the empire falls and there is no king of kings left to tell you, no, change it. Actually, wait, this is probably better. So we're starting to define things, but definitely not there to discuss it yet. But yeah, in any case, Cartier the High Priest would become extraordinarily powerful. And we'll see more in the next episodes. He is a recurring character. He becomes so powerful that he writes his own biography in stone, just like Shapur himself did. And he claims that he suppressed heresies across the empire during Hormizd's reign.
You know when you're told, like, don't write it in stone just yet, we're still changing things?
Like, literally, nope, this is what entirely in stone. Yes. And yeah, we're unsure how much Cartier suppressed heresies across the empire because Hormizd seems to be quite a tolerant guy. Doesn't really persecute anybody, so it might just be Cartier trying to make himself look powerful and strong and saying, "Ah, yes, I did this, all this." On the other hand, instead, we have the prophet Mani who's walking around and building up his new religion. So, as we remember from last time, just a quick recap, Manichaeism is a religion that joins Mazdaism, Christianity, Buddhism, some strange versions of Christianity, fully orthodox.
We talked about how it, like, it could have been one of the main religions, but it just died off.
Yeah. Also, I got to thinking between the last episode and this one that Mani claiming he's a reincarnation of the Buddha kind of contradicts the whole point of the Buddha. Isn't it that he escaped the circle of reincarnation? But, you know, sure, you do you, Mani. I'm not here to criticize you.
Are you not, though?
I mean, I'm here to, you know, it's a dead religion. It's fine. Nobody's going to write angry letters to us. It's cool.
We hope.
if modern Manichaeans, if you've survived for the past 1,000 years, please tell us. Be excited
would
to
love
hear.
To have your input. It would be fun, actually.
But Mani himself was given as an audience by the King of King Hormizd. And they had a chat, and Hormiz seems to have been quite impressed. He was so impressed that everybody agrees that he gave Mani permission to convert anybody he wanted in Babylonia.
Right, right. He was like, yeah, go do your pilgrimage.
Yeah, it's like, feel free, do whatever you want. If anybody wants to join your religion, feel free.
You have no my problems. Blessing. Yeah. I won't join, but go on.
Well, according to the most favorable sources, Manichaean sources, of course.
Of course.
Hormizd himself converted. He thought, you actually make some good points. We shouldn't be terrible to each other. Being nice to each other sounds like a good plan. Let's go with that.
And I mean, converted. I agree. You know, being nice to each other sounds like a good plan. And yeah. Most religions have some sort of clause about that.
Yeah. So, you know, most prophets tend to have the common message of, wouldn't it be nice if we just stopped being mean to each other? Can't we just get along? And Mani kind of agrees. Although, you know, extra things on top. But we'll find out.
Oh.
Next episode, Serial. Don't worry. Mani's still around.
Come on.
And, yeah, the problem is that while the most favorable sources have Hormizd converting, the most unfavorable sources say that Hormizd didn't tell Mani, yes, feel free to convert anyone you want in Babylonia. Hormizd actually told Mani, you can only stay in Babylonia. Don't you dare leave and convert other people elsewhere.
Okay.
So it's unclear if Hormizd is just limiting his influence or is just fully accepting it. It is a very wide range, and we don't really know since, you know, it's a religious matter. It's very polarized.
Hmm.
Everybody is arguing on, oh yeah, he was totally on our side all along. So, who knows? And yeah, Mani himself was a physician who grew up in Babylonia in a Gnostic Christian environment. So, Gnostic Christians are basically Christians who believe that there was some hidden knowledge from the Bible.
Okay.
So this manifests in different ways. Some of them believe that the God of the Old Testament is actually the devil.
Hmm.
And so that's all trickery. And God is actually the serpent who gave the knowledge of good and evil to Adam and Eve.
Actually,
and he
that
came
is
back
such
as
a
Jesus.
Cool concept of just like reinterpreting the text. Which of course everybody has to do, right?
Yeah.
But such a wild interpretation that can have so many consequences. And I love that this is just like this one theory that creates this entire
It's a massive
side of
deal.
Yeah.
And also another version of this is, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's the Gospel of Judas.
I might.
Where it says that Judas the traitor
actually
was the only person who really understood Jesus' message, and all the apostles were just listening to the surface of it, but they didn't understand the deeper message. And in this gospel, Jesus and Judas are talking, and Jesus says, yes, you definitely understand more, but not yet. It's deeper than that. You need to really think about it. So, interesting stuff.
I just want to compare it to just online discourse, for example, within a fandom, and how like piece of media or a piece of art gets reinterpreted. And there are all of these layers and all of these subtleties that if you put these and these together, then like you can logically conclude that this and this is happening. And like it, you know, sometimes there's nothing that like refutes that interpretation, but also it doesn't contradict another interpretation. So I love this. I love just getting different points of view.
Yeah, so that's cool. And
really how you could reinterpret the same content in completely different ways, like the same material in completely different ways. That's really amazing.
Yeah, so that's fun. And yeah, so Mani grew up in this Gnostic Christian environment, and the religion he founded had strong influences from Christianity and Mazdaism, Buddhism from the environment he lived in, and he gained many converts from the Christians in the empire. A lot of them had been imported by Shapur, and also from the Mazdaean people who were unhappy with the Orthodox religion that Kartir was establishing. So Kartir was saying certain things, they disagreed. What Mani said made more sense, so they're saying, okay, well, let's shift to your side. In his new religion, Mani taught that there is an opposition between spirit and matter, where spirit is good and matter is evil, which is sort of in contradiction to what Zoroastrianism says, where all beautiful things are built by Ahura Mazda and should be enjoyed. Mani thinks that he goes for a more ascetic side. he says that you should try and separate yourself from the material world as much as possible and concentrate on the spirit. And so there's this big dualist element. And he is waiting for Jesus to return and resurrect all the Manichaeans, taking them to heaven. And he also did a very good job of propagating his religion by making sure to translate it in as many languages as possible.
That helps.
And right. He presented himself as a prophet, sending everybody and trying to consolidate all the religions he had around him. Apparently, he was only hostile to one religion, and that is the Jewish religion.
Of course. I was like, is it the Jews?
Yes.
What on earth? Why? What is this?
Well, the reason is that the Jews had been around in Mesopotamia since the old Parthian days, and with the Christian communities, there was some friction, and since that's the community Mani grew up in, he dislikes the Jews.
Unbelievable.
So, not great, but...
Every time.
Yes, it is a complicated matter. They can't catch a break. No, they wish for the days of Cyrus to come back again one day. But back to Hormizd, it looks like he was unlikely to have fully converted. Like, yes, we have sources that say he did, but it would be very weird since the establishment of kingship is very based on Mazdaism.
Yeah.
And there are traditional family ties, so it's possible, but...
Probably would have had a bigger impact later on.
Yeah, it's likely that he would have left more of a legacy of it, but it seems that it just kind of carried on. So either he just converted shortly before his death and, well, didn't have time to have effect, or it didn't really happen. But in any case, we can assume that he followed his predecessor's attitude towards religion, where he used it as a legitimizing force, but he wasn't exclusive to one or the other, making sure that the crown wasn't faced with a unified front, and he could just use it as necessary and play them against each other if it happened. So that's quite a good thing to see. But unfortunately, we don't get much of a chance to see what his policies would have been or how they would have worked out, because Hormizd died in June of 271.
Oh.
And we don't know how he died, but the succession was quite interesting.
Okay.
Because you remember that elaborate succession plan that Shapur had put?
Yes.
Well, we're not following that one.
Okay.
But also we're not going with Hormizd's adult son.
Okay. I don't like where this is going.
Yes.
You're like, yes. Yes, as in you neither, or like...
Yeah, it's not good. Because the eldest brother, a man called Bahram, comes to the throne with the great support of the head priest Kartir.
Oh, I don't like that.
And Bahram is very favorable to Zoroastrianism over any other religion, as we'll see in the future. And he is very comfortably there with the high priest Kartir, who becomes even more outrageously powerful. So this also may give some legitimacy to the fact that Hormizd converted, and maybe he accidentally fell off a bridge, and his more Zoroastrian brother succeeded.
I was not expecting to give more credit to the fact that he might have converted. I was very ready to dismiss it, but with this new information, now I'm like...
It could be, who knows?
Yeah, maybe, actually.
But more on that next time. We'll see
what
Bahram does. Also, just to let you know what kind of person Bahram is, do you know where he was ranked in his father's rank of children?
Boy. Oh, God.
Can you guess? Any idea?
How many children did he have?
Shapur had... He had 4 children who had been ranked.
Oh. Was he the very last?
Well, Sariel.
Well, I mean, was he, like, not in the rank? Because, like...
He was not even ranked.
Yeah.
He was the oldest son, but he was not even ranked in terms of capability.
Yeah.
So we'll see if Shapur was right to absolutely not rank this man who was the eldest son and thus traditionally expected to succeed.
Just from how you're talking about him, I'm willing to say that Shapur knew what he was doing.
Yeah, it looks like, yeah. I'm not very fond of Bahram and his line. But, yeah, we'll find out more about that next time, because
so we say goodbye to the good times soon. At least not in this episode, though.
No, this time.
Entirely.
Did a fine job. Everything was pretty much fine. But yeah, so are you ready to rate Hormizd cereal?
Yeah, I guess so.
Let's go. So our first category is final moments. How interesting was his death? Hormizd, well, he died relatively mysteriously. He was, like, based on his age, he was somewhere between 40 and 60, in his 40s or 60s. So, still relatively young. It's unlikely to be a death from old age at this point. Mm-hmm. So maybe he just caught a disease, or maybe, again, since the succession is kind of messy after him, perhaps yeah. he was removed
no,
from the picture.
Yes, I support the theory that this was usurpation. Especially because it was the eldest brother who might have had, like, heirs of grandiose, you know, like, I should have been the heir.
Yeah.
I should have gotten the throne. My father never loved me. I will prove him wrong.
Lots
kind
of daddy
vibes.
Issues.
I do think there was...
It is suspicious. And if you give credence to the religious conversion, like, even if he was just interested in the religion, the fact that the head priest supports his usurper brother is questionable.
Yeah, I mean, or even it might have then been added to, like, give the brother a reason.
Oh, it might be, yeah, to legitimize Bottom instead of Hormizd, saying, yeah, Hormizd was a heretic, so he can be your king.
Whether he was or not, it's less relevant.
Yeah, it's kind of lost to history, but he was definitely tolerant of them, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so what are you thinking for final moments? What is your range?
The thing is, we don't have his actual death.
No, we don't have a death scene. We just know that he dies.
But there's a lot of intrigue surrounding it.
Yes. Not a.
So I will give some points instead of just being like, well, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't give him as many points as I would like to give because, well, we have no details. So
if we knew for sure there was a coup and we had a fancy scene, then yeah, of course. But right now he is a bit off.
I'll give it a 2.
A 2? Only a 2. I was hovering between a 3 and a 4, honestly.
Mm.
Oh. I think I'll go for a 3, but...
Wait, we don't have the actual death. That's my issue.
Yeah, but a 2 is what Shapur got for dying, you know, nice and calm and everything was fine. Like, I guess, you know, I understand if you want to give him a 2, I understand your reasoning, but I feel like the murkiness is enough to raise it up to a 3 for me.
Yeah, I'll stay with a 2.
Fair enough. So with a 3 and a 2, we get a 2.5 out of 10 for final moments. Our next category is battle hardness. How good was he at war and fighting? Well, he was apparently quite good. Like, he didn't do much warring as a king, but as a prince, he was excellent. He was called, you know, Hormizd the Brave. He was known as a great warrior. He helped out his father during wars and was so good that he was made king of Armenia for it.
Mm-hmm. True, true.
He then helped Shapur with his wars against the Romans, invaded Cappadocia, captured the port of Seleucia on his own, and, you know, was clearly quite powerful militarily. Then, as a king, he didn't really go to war, but, you know, it's not that he was defeated or anything, it's just that there was no war at the time, so he wasn't fighting anyone.
Yeah. Which,
so
you know,
I think
it's
pretty good. I think it's quite nice. And, you know, considering how well his father did, we need to give some credit to Hormizd as well.
Yeah.
Maybe not all of it, because, of course, his father was probably directing the overall strategy, but if Hormizd had been terrible, things would have gone a lot worse. So, my starting ground is a 5-ish. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame that he didn't have... So, hear me out. It's a bit of a shame that he didn't have a chance to prove himself as a king militarily, but also that is excellent. And, like, on another hand.
Yeah.
Because that means there's no conflict and you can just enjoy peace and, you know, have your empire or your kingdom actually thrive. So, I'm not saying that it's actually bad. It's just for the sake of points. Well,
yeah, for the sake of fightiness, yeah.
But we do have the account of how he did before he became king.
Yeah, also... Which, based on Shapur's list, he was the best of his sons.
Wow. Yeah. So, true.
You know, he's not just some random guy.
We know that Shapur, like, as cruel as it might have been to rank your sons, it's also done from a place of you are hiring someone for a job and not, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm not excusing him because maybe, I don't know what kind of person he was, and maybe it was very much, I hate you and I love you kind of relationship,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we don't endorse making a Rexy pod for all of your children and choosing which one is better than the others.
Please do not do that. But if you're choosing someone for a job, you know.
Yeah.
Which he was very practical in that sense, because that's how he treated the rest of the kingdom. Like, he would just he would micromanage everything and be like, okay, this is, which I'm saying, like, oh, he's micromanaging, which usually has like a bad connotation. He was the king. I feel like that's part of his job.
Yeah. The job is,
you can delegate, but like, you don't have to, especially if you're good at what you do.
So yeah, I think that considering his overall skill, the fact that his father rated him so highly, I'm going to go for a 6 in battle hardness.
Yeah, I'm going to match you because, you know, we're going from the Shapur list on this one. And, you know, he actually met the guy, so.
So, very good. With a 6 and a 6, we get a 12 out of 20 for battle hardness. Our next category is scheminess. How good was he at plots and manipulations?
Did he, like...
There is a very, very minor thing we could consider, because overall doesn't do much schemey. His minor thing is that he might be playing the Zoroastrians against the Manichaeans to ensure that none of them becomes too powerful, or he might just be tolerant because it's a nice thing to do.
Yes.
You know,
or he might just be a nice guy.
Depends how cynical you are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I am a big fan of monarchs who just allow freedom of religion for their people. Yeah. Even
it's
if,
a nice thing
like,
to do.
In this dynasty, we are much more geared towards having one religion that is the royal religion. Mm-hmm. It's not like the rest of religions are being prosecuted.
No, so absolutely not.
I just think it's a nice thing to do, whether you do it strategically or just because, you know, live and let live. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're not considering a bit of the scheminess.
Less important, because in the end, like, the reason behind doesn't really matter. The outcome matters.
Okay, fair enough. So yeah, you've actually convinced me. I think there's nothing really for
in this
for
case. There are cases where the reason behind does matter. But,
I mean,
you know.
Yeah, of course. But sure. Yeah, I think, okay, so I'm going to go for 0 for scheminess. I guess you're matching.
There wasn't really anything.
Okay. So with a 0 and a 0, we get a 0 out of 20 for scheminess. Our next category is shock factor. How shocking was this man? We don't have too much. The one thing I think we have is the potential conversion to a different religion.
Yeah.
How much credit do you want to give that? Because if he did convert, that's pretty big. You know, he died before it could have a great effect, but, you know, that could have sent the empire in a totally different direction.
True.
But, you know, we're not sure if he did. Some people say he did. Some people say he actually just tried to limit Manichaeanism to a certain region.
I don't know enough to make, like, a more informed opinion. Just for the sake of storytelling, I think it's a good... Like, if this were a story someone were writing, I'd be like, it makes sense that this was the reason for his downfall.
Yeah, if you want to spice it up for drama...
And his
yes.
downfall was so quick that nothing came of it. Because people made sure that nothing came of it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, clearly, if Cartier is willing to replace him so quickly, he probably didn't like the man too
it's
much.
It's that priest favoring the brother that threw me for a loop, you know?
Yeah, that's the one which makes you stroke your chin a little bit.
Hmm.
Because, yeah, I think I'm just going to go for a token one because it might be. We don't know. But there's a taste of something there.
It's not unthinkable.
Yeah, exactly. It's possible. Who knows? Also, you know, the thing is that, you know, Zoroastrianism wasn't consolidated in an orthodox form. And Manichaeanism took a lot of parts from Mazdaism. You know, and a lot of disaffected Mazdaeans who didn't like the Zoroastrian mainstream moved into Manichaeanism, so... It might make sense that Hormizd saw the way the religion was turning and said, no, I actually like this version better, so I'll convert to this. So, yeah. Actually, I've talked myself up. I'm going to go for a 2 because I think that...
That makes sense.
There is some spice there.
Mm.
And yeah, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with you.
2 as well?
With this new evidence, I'm like,
nice. Okay, so with a 2 and a 2, we get a 4 out of 20 for shock factor.
I thought you were going to say for Zoroastrianism.
No.
2 out of 20 for Zoroastrianism. Another also. Victory. For what's it called? Ahura Mazda?
Ahura Mazda.
Yeah. I am paying attention, you guys. I just...
Yes.
I'm bad with names.
It's cool. Our next category is Aaron Shine. How good was he for the Empire in general and Iran in particular? Well, by all accounts, he was a just and capable king. He did a good job. He was skilled. Everybody agrees that he wasn't as skilled as his father and grandfather, but to be fair,
it's a lot.
They were very skilled. It was difficult to live up to that.
The fact that he's not completely obscured by them and people were still like, no, no, he was great, like, says a lot.
Yeah, everybody says he did a great job. If we can believe the hand story, you know, the message of it anyway is that he was super loyal as a son and made sure that he helped his father as much as possible. So even during his father's reign, he was helping out. He did a good job. During his own reign, he founded new cities, which is always a positive thing to do. He established religious toleration across the empire. That's nice.
Yeah.
And yeah, he didn't do anything incredibly high, incredibly powerful, but he did a good job. The empire's continuing well.
Didn't he also get to the throne relatively old?
Yeah, I mean, he got to the throne in 40s or 60s, depending.
So he didn't have
40s
that
to 60s.
Much time.
Especially no, he didn't have as much time as his father and grandfather, so
you know.
He might have been able to establish a more permanent legacy, but unfortunately, this was the wrench in Shapur's plans that his son got there fairly old, and things happened, whether they were poisony things or natural deathy things, who knows. But yeah, I think for Aaron Shine, I'm going to go with a 6, because he kept the Empire stable, made it a little bit better. But, you know, no fireworks, but a solid performance.
Yeah. Cool.
So, you also win a 6? Okay. Yep. So, with a 6 and a 6, we get a 12 out of 20 for Aaron Shine. Our next category is Face of Faces. What do you think this man looked like? And I will send you his crown.
Hey.
I like that we have crowns now. That's fun.
Apparently, he looked like his grandfather, right?
Yeah, he looked a lot like his grandfather. So... You know, if you want to take inspiration, here we go. I've sent it to you in the diagram I have. It's spelled in a different way from the way I'm spelling it, but you know.
Yeah.
The consonants are vaguely there. Don't look at the vowels. That's the secret of reading through Sassanid historiography. Just look at the consonants. The vowels change.
Is it one of those languages that are written without vowels?
Now, I don't know about how it works in the ancient time. But modern Persian uses the Arabic script, so it has some vowels that are important and others which you can also not write. So some vowels are really relevant, others are just like, yeah, it's roughly this sound. You know, we understand what you mean. Okay, so Cyril has finished their drawing. Let me pick it up and I'll describe it to you all. That's nice. I like that. I love what you did with the beard. It's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we have here is our dear friend Hormizd. He has a lovely crown. It has like a big silk poof on top with little decorations on the side, little ringlets they look like. Then he is there. He has a nice long curly hair, as our kings are accustomed to. He has a nice well-groomed beard, and coolly enough, it's sort of put like in a ponytail at the front. It's like a long beard, but it's tied up. So it looks very nice and neat. He is wearing the traditional Iranian tunic with some pants. And in front of himself, he's holding out a powerful war bow, as all good kings should.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of his head, floating full of pride, is a lovely banner that says Daddy's favorite. Because we all know who Daddy likes best. He wrote a list explaining it in exhaustive detail.
Yep. Don't get me wrong. I'm not against it. I think he was right.
Yeah. If you're not on the list, well, then you should wonder why. But yes, thank you, Cyril. That's very nice. And yeah, if anybody wants to see this portrait, you can go on the Discord if you're a patron, or you can go in the episode notes or on our website in Cyril's portrait gallery.
Yep.
Now let me show Cyril what he actually looked like. And this time, I'm sorry to say that we only have a coin. We don't have a relief anymore.
Oh, come on. It happens. That's such a shame.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. The reliefs are very cool. They'll be back, but not yet.
Okay.
So, here he is.
Ooh. But this is nice. I like it. Really it's a nice coin. It's good. Yeah. I like the slight stylization of it. The crown looks really cool.
Mm-hmm.
It has little hooks or swirls on the sides, and then it had this like poof of fabric, I assume, like the other crowns on the top. And the hair, I love how the hair is done because it's so like swirly with curls in it.
It looks like really good curls there.
Yeah. Like, that's true. It's got a beard, and then like the very point of it is pulled into a little ponytail.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really cool.
Also, I like the detail that on the poof on top of his crown, there are all these dots.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they are exactly, but it would be really cool if the crown were blue and those were dots representing stars.
Oh, I'd definitely do that. That would be amazing.
That sounds great. We don't have color on this, unfortunately, but, you know, it'd be a cool idea. Why not?
Yeah. I mean, cool character design. I will write that down.
My there next you go. Keep it in D&D mind for adventure. The future.
Yeah.
And what do you think about his portrait? How would you rate him?
Well, it's another coin, which is a bit of a shame, but it is a really pretty coin. So I'll give it a 5, I think.
Only a 5? I'm actually very impressed with, like, the starry crown.
I mean, you made that up, but...
There are dots there. You know, could be. It could just be random pearls, but you could just make it into a starry thing. Mm. I think I like it enough to make it... I'm actually going to go for a full 7.
Wow.
Because I think it's a good coin, and a good coin deserves a 6. But I think this one's slightly over, so it deserves a 7 for me.
I forget what we've given coins before, which is why like my rating here is always like, I don't know.
You know, 5 is like, it's good, but nothing to write home about.
No, then I'll move go up at or least down with a 6. Because, yeah. But it's still a coin. We've seen many.
Fair enough.
Although I do think I would be able to pick this one out.
It's distinctive enough. Okay, let me write that down. So with a 7 and a 6, we get a 3.3 out of 5 for Face of Faces. Our next category is lengthiness. How long do you think this man reigned? And we're not counting his reign as King of Armenia. Yep. We're just counting when he was king.
I will say 15 years. It's probably a lot. I don't know.
Well, you are way off.
Yeah.
Way off.
I'm just thinking now, I'm like, well, no, because he went to the throne like between 40 and 60 already. So
yeah,
maybe just 5 years.
Still pretty off.
Wow.
He reigned a grand total of 1 year and 1 month.
Oh, really?
Yes,
I mean,
it's really
sad. It is true that we had a pretty short episode. Like, it was over pretty soon. We didn't have much to say. But still...
It's really sad that he was the chosen heir and he was the golden boy
this was
and just
definitely
like died
a
year in.
Like, I'm sorry. This is, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's not
the
great.
The primogenitor.
It's very suspicious.
How would you say?
The firstborn.
Primogenitor is such a good word. Come on, people. But the firstborn son just did not take it well.
No. So yeah, Hormizd ruled from May of 270 to June of 271. Giving him a grand total of 1 year, which divided by 10 is 0.1 points out of 5 for lengthiness. And that brings us to the final score, which is a very impressive, like, more than most Parthian kings, 33.9 out of 100. Which places him just above Diarches and under Vologases I, which was one of the more impressive Parthian kings, so, you know. Very good score. You know, the worst Sassanid so far. But the others have been all in the top 6. So it's kind of a harsh comparison. And that leads us to the final question. Is Hormizd the favorite enough, short-lived enough, and merciful enough to be a Shahanshah? Or is he just a Shahana?
I don't think he lived enough.
Like, I think it's just a real shame that he didn't live though. That long. Yeah.
He would have been a perfect Shahanshah, like perfect Shahanshah material.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just such a shame that he lived so little. Ugh. And that it just, you know, through coup or just random malaria or whatever disease he may have caught, he just didn't have enough time to make his mark. And, you know, if he actually did convert to Manichaeanism and then took the empire in that new direction, that would have been really interesting and really impactful. And otherwise, he seems to have been really capable as king of Armenia. He was the favorite of his father, who clearly was a reasonable judge of character, mm-hmm. since he hated Bahram. So fair enough. You did a good job at that. So yeah, it's very disappointing, but I'm sorry, Hormizd, but you are a Shahana. So you can go off into the desert and meet Vologases VI and tell him that you were much better than him. Like, mathematically, about 5 times better than him.
Yes.
But unfortunately, you just did not cut it. You did not last long enough.
That's so sad.
So yeah, thank you all for listening. We hope you had a good time with our friend Hormizd and learning about the new religions that are popping up and how they all interact. We hope you join us next time when Bahram starts. We'll see. Does this potential
I already don't
usurper...
Like him. No.
Yeah, you're right. I don't like him either.
Eat the entire
see
man.
If he does a good job. Does he do a good job? Does he mess things up more? Oh, and wait. What is that over the horizon? Is that a Diocletian coming? Oh, no.
Fun.
What's that going to do for us?
I can't stop thinking about Shapur just coming down in spirit and just slapping the hell out of this man for not following his plan.
Yes.
Come on, like he left everything. We didn't even check if the plan would have worked because nobody followed it, even though he was pretty
great
at,
point.
You know.
But don't worry, Sariel, there is somebody who wants to continue following the plan, and he is going to try his damnedest to try and make sure it works.
So we're you going to make me suffer next episode. Cool.
A lot.
Cool.
But yeah, in the meantime, if you want to support us, you can join our Patreon, where you can gain a lot of extra episodes. We have episodes on the Maurya dynasty, a bunch of cool ancient Greeks, contemporaries of Mithridates II, other series we're going to be voting for in March. Join us. It's fun. And if you don't want to support us monetarily, that's fine, but we'd still appreciate if you could give us a review on your podcast app of choice so more people know that we exist. And yeah, I think that's it. Without any further ado, we hope you have a lovely week, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.